How could it not be that she could foresee this problem when everything is right in front of her? The lies that she threw out there as an individual saying this. Now let's go back to the automotive industrial. You got the big three that are leaving the state of Michigan. The state of Michigan no longer is the motor capital of the world because they're all leaving. We found that we are now no longer able to keep that industrial going. So what does she do? She brings in Toyota, start building plants, give them a tax break with no union. What is that going to do with us as it stands right now? She's bringing in an import to build here in the state of Michigan when the big three are leaving, knowing that it's not going to work.
Well, exactly. That's just it. She's turning it around, you know, somehow, or at least she thinks it's what's happened. Other manufacturers are going to have to come and take their place. You know, somewhere along the line, she's just going to start losing population. I mean, Michigan had a mad exodus out of Michigan and down to Texas back in the 80s. I don't know if a lot of you people remember that. As a matter of fact, there's still housing tracts down in Texas that are empty that were built for all that immigration that was happening down there. And not a good thing. Not a good thing at all. She's, I don't know what she's trying to do. I really don't, in the end. You know, trying to, guess, bring them in there. But, you know, why not extend those same tax breaks to the manufacturers that are already there? And, you know, and at some point in time, these unions are going to have to understand that they cannot take care of workers forever beyond them working there. You know, they really can't. I mean, one of the biggest problems they have there and that we have in this country is the fact that there's so much benefits tied into the price of each and every car. You know, it's totally amazing. I mean, what is it, $3,200? To take care of each, of $3,200 of a car's total cost to the dealer includes $1,600 of current employees, or I'm sorry, $1,400 of the current employee, his pay and his benefits, but $1,800 heads to people that no longer work on the cars at all, people who are retired and out of there, and this is taking care of them for the rest of their life. Now, obviously, a good deal if you're an automotive worker. I mean, this is, you know, something you want to see. I mean, you put your 20, 25 years in, and bang, you are handled for the rest of your life. Good incentive to go to work for the car manufacturers. But, you know, somebody along the line there ended up cutting his own throat. Look at where the business is going. You know, not a good thing. All right, Hunter, your hands back up. Go right ahead, buddy. And folks, the room is open, you know. I'd love to see some hands up there.
And I'm trying to give you a hand here, BB, on talking points. As you look at it right now, when the big three first started out, it was a big rush to go ahead and get with the best manufacturer you possibly could. You had Ford, GM, you had Chrysler. So GM, they were working, they were employing a bunch of people, they kept opening up plant after plant after plant, giving the best benefits. They didn't realize that down the road, pretty soon, we are going to be exhausting ourselves of all these vehicles that, well, they're not selling. GM is putting out thousands of vehicles a year that are left on lots, and they're accusing us, saying that it's our fault that we're not buying them. Well, we put them out there for you. It's your fault that you're not buying them, so now we've got to leave. That, to me, is fiscal irresponsibility. You make what is in demand. Don't overflood the corporation and, you know, the population of what is going on. That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. Why build more? And we're getting into the housing, the exact same principle that is what's going on now with the housing. They are building, they are cutting down the woods, the trees, taking away the forest, taking away from the wildlife, all of that aggravation. And these houses, one or two houses are sitting on cleared lots of 20 acres. And they're not selling. They've been sitting there. I've got one at the end of my road that's been sitting there for a year. And there's it's an 8-acre lot. Just my word. Go ahead, Wild.
Bob Wood, the mic is yours, bud.
Well, thank you, folks. You know, the thing of the automobiles, the unions basically made the automakers sign contracts that they're going to keep these people busy. Okay? So it's not that they're blaming the consumer. I've never heard that. But I do believe that the unions themselves might be part of the problem as far as automobile manufacturing is concerned, and all them automobiles sitting out on the parking lots. I do remember back in 1976, the General Motors went on strike for job security. The workers did. The unions did. They went on strike for job security. Now, how can you go on strike for job security? That is when I left Michigan. That is the honest to God's truth. That was one of the biggest reasons why I left Michigan back then. You cannot guarantee the sale of a mass-produced item if beyond what the consumer is going to buy as far as the amount of that product. So, you know, and they're trying to do it again. They went on strike today again for the same doggone thing. Does this make any sense, folks?
No, it sure doesn't. And you're right, stuffing things, you know, stuffing the market full of stuff like that, you know, and expecting people to buy it. I mean, when it ends up happening, people see this, and they would just wait for the end of the year, and then sales come through, and they'll buy them then. But even then, on top of it, it's, you know, there are other forces that are in effect here that are really killing them. You know, I sold cars through the 90s, and I watched, you know, the inflation in the 90s being a lot worse than it was, and then it was reported. And don't forget, you know, how Bill Clinton tried to hide it all, too, by restructuring how the CIR looked there, or the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. You know, remember all the things that were taken off of it because it was volatile items and whatnot. But, I mean, I watched the price of a Buick LeSabre climb from $17,998 in 1993 to $28,670 by 1998. Exact same car, and I'm talking about nothing had changed. They retooled absolutely nothing to build that car. It's the exact same model. Any part off of any of them will fit any of the later ones. The only thing that changed was they went from the composite front fenders back to steel front fenders at one point because they were having a problem with them. But beyond that, nothing changed, just the price of the car skyrocketed. But on top of that, something else actually took effect. And this was a very big consternation to many of us in the business of just selling the cars. And that effect was the fact that the American car rental companies were buying record numbers of American vehicles, which was obviously good for the American car manufacturers. But on the other end of things, it did a lot of harm in the business itself. Now, these car rental places would buy cars in lots and droves. You know, they would take delivery of 100 cars a day at some points. And these cars went into service, and they were generally scheduled to stay in service for 1 to 2 years. And at the end of that 1 or 2 year period, those 100 cars that came in on a specific day all went back out on a specific day and went right to the auction. And the used car dealers, myself included, were down at the auction just buying these things up like they were going out of style. And what had happened was a huge kind of a throat-cutting thing for anyone that was buying American cars in the private sector. Now, what would happen is you took your typical person out there who bought a car for 2 or 3 years, thank you, baby, and you know, we trade them in maybe every 2, 3, 4 years. Well, we would go down to the sale, and you would take a car that went $21,000, $22,000, brand new. 1 year later at the sale, with under 10,000 miles on it, the car was worth approximately one-third the price. Of course, we're snapping them up because here we are. We're able to offer people 1 and 2 year old cars, you know, for half the price, and we're making that difference on them. I mean, you're talking about take a Ford Taurus that came off the line at $21,000, $22,000. We were buying for between $7,000 and $8,000 at the auction, selling them on our lot for $12,000, and making $3,000-$4,000 a shot on the car, as compared to making $1,800 on a brand new one. Well, you're a car salesman. You know, what are you going to do? You got somebody who's coming in the lot looking for a new car. Well, hey, yeah, you know, you can go over there and buy that brand new Ford Taurus for $21,000. Or I'll tell you what, you can buy this one here that's only a year old, has less than 10,000 miles, still has all the factory warranty on it, has been serviced regularly, has been cleaned regularly, and take a look at it. It's a good car. Still got the balance of the factory warranty, blah, 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 and it's only half the price. You know, it's, there you have it, folks. I mean, it was a no-brainer for most people. A no-brainer for me. My last three cars that I have purchased were exactly the same way. Were either off of leases or off of rentals. So it was kind of like, you know, wham. People who came in, now, here's the worst part about it is, you got a two-year-old Taurus that you paid $20,000 2 years ago on. You took it out on a five-year deal. You still owe $14,000 on the car. Well, the car is only worth $8,000 or $9,000 on a trade-in, which puts you in a completely upside-down position trying to trade that car in. You know, which means if you wanted to buy that new car, you had to pay off $5,000 of your old loan, or at least be able to come up with that much money to put down on your new car to pay off the old loan. You were losing money. You know, most people who were, and at that point, they just turned right around, drove off that lot, and drove that car into the ground. And, you know, so it really didn't do a lot. And, I mean, some of the creative financing we were going through was crazy. You know, a lot of times, you know, we would take a look at somebody like, come in here, and this is a regular customer every 3-4 years. So what we would end up doing is, you know, we talked to banks, and the banks would go right along with this, is to balloon a payment at the end of it. For, you know, you'd have a 5-year loan, but the problem is at the end of the 5-year loan, you had $5,000 came due all at once. Now, you know, telling people, just don't keep the car 4 years, just trade it in. You know, you should still be worth the $4,000 or $5,000 at the end of the loan. The fact of the matter is, they weren't. And it was a nutty situation. So what ended up happening was, the American car rental companies really did a number on the retail business end of it. All right, Hunter, your hand's back up. Go right ahead, bud.
Just want to go ahead and give you a break and let you get a drink there. Basically, yeah, I can see where you're coming on how they're operating on, you know, on the fundamentals of buy and sell on the automotive BS. It's one of those type of things where you lease or buy. If you go in and lease, you can keep giving your vehicle and getting a new one every 2 or 3 years, however you want to go ahead and play the game. But how it happened and actually how it started, well, I do believe it was like 6 years ago when everybody started needing to get these vehicles off the lot. They said, bring in your old car and we'll give you, I'm saying hypothetical, you know, push it, pull it, tow it, or drag it, it doesn't matter, we'll give you $5,000, you know, for the vehicle. So all these people were bringing in their used vehicles and a glut, and these new vehicles were going in or going out. Now they had this glut of all these used vehicles, and they didn't know what to actually do with them. Then they started selling those things for dirt cheap. They started losing, and then the cycle started coming back again. And here I am. I'm in my fourth lease on a Ford. No, my third lease. I'm sorry. My third lease. 01, 03, and an 05. And I'm getting ready to get rid of this one, which I kind of like. I don't mind it. You know, I don't even wear the tires out before I get rid of it. But the, you know, the overflow of the aggravation that's turned in has got to go somewhere, and then the leases are actually going somewhere, and they're still complaining. Go ahead, I'll ask.
Yeah, thank you. What happened to this room about 15, 20 minutes ago? It disappeared. What happened with that? It wasn't Pal Talk, so you all know. So, you know. Right, I just wanted to let you know. We had to reboot. Okay, so is it like the whole, just your room had to get rebooted? I was just wondering about that. I'm like, I was in both rooms, and all of a sudden just, bing, gone. And I was like, whoa, what happened? I was wondering about that. Thank you for your time. Anyway, whoever wants the mic, go ahead.
Yeah, we had a technical glitch about 5 minutes before the show started up here. Like I said, I think we bounced Bob out of here, my producer over at HearnNet Radio, and I haven't seen him make his way back in yet. Poor guy. It was everybody was sounding like they were talking out of a helicopter. Ah, oh, Bob is here. I knew you were in there somewhere. I didn't see your name on the list. You got a big room here tonight, Bob. Oh, there we go. I didn't have the thing kick, and I got an ad just whacked up here on me here. Yeah, that's okay. Not a problem. But it's, craziness reigns supreme, you know. So I don't know. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know how to chalk all this up, what's going on with it. You know, it's an evolution, you know, as far as the car manufacturing process goes in this country. Personally, I think that what you're going to see over the next few years is either these car manufacturers taking a totally different tack, or what I suspect, and although this may be iffy, predicated upon other conditions, you may see other car manufacturers starting to arise out of the dust, new ones. You know, I think of Mr. DeLorean. You know, Mr. DeLorean probably would be in the market right now to make a whole lot of money. He'd just offer an alternative. And I think that is what you're going to end up seeing. Now, the thing about it is, come out with a new car, it's going to take a lot. It really is. And the problem here is multifaceted. Biggest problems you have, obviously, to begin with, are the market. But the second biggest problem, and this has also been plaguing the American car companies, is the government regulation and control. You know, and that is something that they got to stop and think about. Now, you remember I did 6-7 months ago here, I had said that the Senate or the House, one of the two of them, basically rang the death bell for the American car companies because they were coming out with new regulations for automotive gasoline mileage. And I said at the time that they were ringing the bell for the death bell. The death bell was tolling away because basically what they were doing was going to drive them out of business. And it was sad. I mean, they started this process when they introduced CAFE regulations way back when. You know, the corporate average fuel economy, which I don't care what anybody says, killed many, many people out there. You know, corporate average fuel economy, folks, means that each corporation has to reach a sustainable average. Okay, which meant that for every vehicle they were building that had very low gas mileage, they had to build something else to offset that gas mileage. You know, as a result, GM went and bought Toyota's and made Metros. I'm sorry, who made the Toyota Metro? The Geo Metro was actually a Suzuki product, now that I think about it. But, you know, they built the Geo's, the Prisms, which were actually Toyota controllers, rebadged and renamed, came out of the same plant out there in Fullerton, California, as the Toyota Corolla. You had Ford's buying all these little little crappy imports, not necessarily Japanese, but just doing this, building little tiny boxes with little tiny engines that would get extremely good gas mileage, but otherwise be, you know, fairly worthless. Of course, there were people out there buying them. Great for your commuters that were living in cities and didn't have to go too far and didn't have to worry about too much other truck traffic on the road. But, you know, that's what goes on here. Yeah, Willie, I hear your nudges there, buddy. Although I don't know what you want. but, you know, the point of the matter is here that they are, you know, that the government regulation getting in the way of this is not a good thing. You know, especially when they're trying to do this. And the thing about it is, it's all the hoaxes that are going on out there. You know, people are still convinced that the oil companies have the car companies in their pockets and that they're building them so that they suck down gas. Well, fact of the matter is, you know, back in the 80s, you know, when we started re-engineering cars and getting rid of carburetors and going to fuel injection and lightening the cars up, they did everything they could back then. And by 1992, and I'm talking 15 years ago, we had been squeezing every drop of energy that could possibly be gotten out of an ounce of gasoline. You know, and every ounce of energy that was in there that could be gotten out of gasoline was put to those tires on the road and moving you around. You know, as a result, hey, you got cars like my Grand Prix out there that get better miles than a Volkswagen used to get. You know, I get 28, 29 miles to the gallon with that car. And it's a mid-sized car. It's a beautiful car. It fits family fine. I love driving it. Fact of the matter is, though, there is no magic formula out there. There are no magic engines. You know, these hybrids, they do a little bit better, but they're not a whole lot better. You know, any way you look at it, power is power. You know, I had this argument with my grandfather when I was a kid. You know, you cannot get more power out of a system than what you put into a system. There's only so much power stored in gasoline. And when you're using it as efficiently as possible, that's it. It won't go any further. And that's exactly where we're at there today. Yes. All right. Good. My buddy there, Mr. Dark Wolf Hudson, you are back in the room. We are on a radio show speaking around the world there, Mr. Dark Wolf. Mic is yours.
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, I realized the radio show was going on. Just basically wanted to say, since we're talking about the car industry in general, while the 1973 oil crisis may have been the forebearer of better fuel economy, and that's great, it did, however, signal the death of the muscle car industry, which is, you know, a tragic event. I think we can all agree that it would have been a good thing had that not happened, since pretty much after 1973, most muscle cars either disappeared or lost huge amounts of power. So, you know, that's one of the major issues, I think, with the fact that while we've got good fuel economy now in our cars, it still would have been nice to have a few muscle cars throughout the 70s that weren't completely bad. That's pretty much all I was going to say. It's your mic, Hunter.
Yeah, that's a good point you made there, you know, as far as the old big high horsepower muscle cars. But, you know, kind of in a way, that changed, I think, for the better. You know, you don't see the drag racers the way they are. You see more of the road racing design. But who is it that's filling that market? You know, anybody out there that's ever seen the Fast and the Furious, any three of the movies, which I love. I don't care what anybody says about the plots in them and everything else. The cars in them are just fabulous. You know, we'll note that a lot of that is going on around the country right now. You know, people taking these small cars and hot rodding them. And they are a blast. They really are. I mean, there's nothing like taking one of them little buggers down a windy country road at top speed. You know, it really is. Hey, it's half the reason I love driving my Grand Prix. You know, I drive the same roads in that Grand Prix that I used to drive with muscle cars 25 years ago. And I got to admit, I'm having more fun now than I was then. Because this Grand Prix really holds the road nicely. And it's my third Grand Prix, and I'll probably buy another one when this one's gone. I just love them. It's one of those cars. I like the wide track and the way they handle, and you know the fact. I mean, it's like this morning. I went on a 40-mile trip back through the, through the woods here to take my daughter down to the train station 3:30 in the morning today. You know, through the dark of night. Well, I was under the stars. It was a beautiful night. And, man, what fun it is blasting that car, especially after I dropped her off and it could really open it up and come back up. But it's muscle cars just aren't what they were. But there's, you know, it's where we're not responding, you know. I mean, yes, we build Mustangs, and yes, we build Corvettes. And the Corvette is obviously, you know, one of the hottest cars in the world out there right now. I mean, it's you know, the way they're eating up the Porsches over on the circuits in Europe is just unbelievable. But, it's not like it used to be, you know, not where everybody could go out and afford the same muscle cars they used to. So they got to turn that around, you know. They got to look in that area. There's nothing wrong with building a small car that goes makes all kinds of neat noises and has a wing on the back and tinted windows and lots of chrome and different colored lights on it. Yeah, people go nuts over that stuff. They really do. Hunter, your hand is up. Go right ahead.
With the way it was back in the days of the 70s and the early 60s, the 60s to 70s, let's go ahead and run it at that era, where you had the V8s, where they needed the horsepower to go ahead and push that kind of weight. Nowadays, with the way technology has gone, all the vehicles are so much lighter now, a six-cylinder pulling higher RPMs can go ahead and get the job done a whole hell of a lot quicker than the old muscle cars and get the job done faster. So the V8s are gone, basically in a nutshell, unless you want to go ahead and do drag strips, so on and so forth. And have you ever thought and taken a look and said, why is it when I fill up my washer fluid, I'm talking back in the days of old, it would never take a full gallon, there was always just a little bit left at the bottom, and you had like three or four of those partial gallons floating around in your garage or on your porch, and you hated it, that was due to weight. The vehicle was designed to hold only so much weight.
That's true. They hold a lot now, though. My Grand Prix will take that entire gallon. Yeah, that's true. You know, it's funny you think about it. You know, I used to have a 65 Oldsmobile Starfire. 425 cubic inch, 370 horsepower, stock out of the box. Nothing would touch that car once it opened up on the highway. Now, of course, it wouldn't stop for anything. God help you if you had to come to a screeching halt with the four big 12-inch drum brakes on it. But that only had a tiny little washer bottle under there. Now I think about it. Dark Wolf, your hand's back up. Go ahead, bud.
Yeah, thanks, man. You know, you said before about the fight, what the Hunter was saying about the fact that, you know, the different size engines and the fact that, you know, nowadays there's a lot more six-cylinder engines compared to back in the day when there was a lot more, you know, V8 engines. I think, you know, to briefly cover this subject, I think you need to realize that, yeah, there's a huge difference between capacity and horsepower output. I mean, you'll get some old muscle cars that would have huge capacity, like 7 liters, like 428 cubic inches, yet would only kick out the same as maybe a modern day four cylinder, normally aspirated. And again, yeah, there's a huge amount that goes into it, whether the heads are polished and ported, whether the carburetor is itself, whether you've got twin barrel or four barrel or six barrel carburetors, whether you've got fuel injection, everything else around the engine, aside from sheer capacity, is what makes the engine most of the time powerful or not. So, you know, I think that needs to be taken into account. That said, in the 1960s, I mean, my personal favorite muscle car is the Mustang. I'm a huge Mustang fan. Well, from the 1964 and a half to 1969, I don't think you can get a better example of American Detroit muscle than, you know, maybe a 428 Cobra Jet, 428. V8, like a 351 Cleveland V8, even the Windsor engines, they're high power engines. I mean, just amazing cars, and what they sound like when they're driven. Never actually owned one, but that's my goal. I definitely want to own one of the high power Mustangs. And you know, I think it's pretty much just encapsulate, you know, that period in America where it's just raw brute muscle, and I don't think pretty much any car of the era could touch it. And, you know, I think that I don't know, when you look at today's engines and you compare them, say, to the Supra engine, Toyota Supra had a 2JZ engine, a 2JZ GTE engine, and that's an inline six, and it's only 3 liter. And if you compare that to some of the old engines, like, say, from Mustangs, which were, you know, like 428 cubic inches, which, again, is about 7 liters, there's a huge disparity there, but the inline six, because it's got 24 valves per cylinder, because it's an inline six, and it's one of the most perfectly balanced engines. You take that engine on stock internals, stock Conrods, and a stock head to over 1,000 horsepower, whereas you couldn't probably do that in the old Mustang. But again, at the same time, even when you're comparing the two, the Japanese super engine is obviously going to be a lot more, you know, able to deal with the power, even though it's smaller capacity, but it does sort of have that Detroit raw muscle that the old Mustang engines did. So, you know, it's a lot to compare the two, and a lot of it is more than just the capacity, but I would still probably take the Mustang engine over the Supra any day. Hunt, you're up, man.
Go ahead there, Mr. Hunter. Thank you, baby. I just want to go ahead and talk with Dark here. But Dark, what you got to realize, the engines that were developed to go ahead and push all that steel, they had to have the torque to get off the line. Nowadays, what I'm saying is, with the plastic that we have, the lightweight, we don't need all that torque off the line. We need quick RPM, quick acceleration. You can get the same response out of a four or a six cylinder with no problem off the line that's only kicking out 120 or maybe 130 horse that you could get out of a vehicle back in the 60s or 70s at 350 to 400 horse off the line. They needed the torque and they needed that much horse to get off the line because of the weight. That's what I'm saying. I'm not taking back anything of what the muscle cars were all about. I, myself, I enjoy the muscle cars. I've had two GTOs. I love them. I had a 67 and I had a 70. My 67 was a tri-power. My 70 was just a quadrajump. I loved it. I enjoyed myself and I had a lot of fun. But the difference is my wife's, where's she running that? The 2000, what is it? It's an 07. It's an 07 Monte Carlo. That thing off the line is just incredible because it's all plastic.
Yeah, well put. Well put. Hey, I hope we're not going to bore everybody to tears with car talk. You landed on one of my favorite subjects. I spent 30 years in the car business and out of love more than anything else, folks. You know, that's. And I'm sorry to say that I will have watched it come and go. You know, I don't think that the personal car transportation idea of America is going to last forever. I really don't. You know, other factors in it that are driving us down the tubes here, too. You know, don't forget. And a lot of it has to do with idiots on the road. Not necessarily in muscle cars either. But we'll get into that for a minute. Wildwood, your hand is up. Got 1 minute before we take a break here. Bud, Mike's all yours.
Well, good. That's about all it'll take. I used to drive a 1969 442. And it was back in 73, something. I can't remember what year it was. I ran up against Datsun B210. This guy decided he was going to try and show me where the bear crept in the woods. And, he's decided to smile at me and go and all that, you know, and I gave mine all that she had. This guy hung in there with me with all that had in a little Datsun B210. Now, this is before it became Nissan. There wasn't much plastic in that car. It was a steel car. It was a light car. But it made me realize then that Ford, General Motors, Chrysler all had their hands full, not only with the economy, but also with the kind of power and speed that these little buggers had. And the thing that bothered me the most was back in the 70s, through the 80s, there was really nothing out there that was from the big three that was showing that they was making any difference in the way that they was manufacturing their cars. And I hate to say this, but I think this right here is one of the biggest drawbacks of the big three back then, along with the high prices of their vehicles. And, like Jack says, I'm sorry, the poor designs of the cars in the 70s, they really had a lot to be desired. I think the minute is up, and BB, I think you can go ahead and announce the break.
All right. Thanks a lot. Yeah. Just as a side note to that, I think one of the progenitors of it all, believe it or not, was a motorcycle. You know, back in the time, there was a lot of high-powered stuff coming out of America with their Harley-Davidsons. They were really experimenting hard with the Sportster, building a 7,500 RPM motor that would develop 100 horsepower. And then all of a sudden, here comes this little company called Suzuki out of Japan, and it built a 250cc single-cylinder bike. It was called a X6 Hustler. And for under $2,000, you could buy a motorcycle that would do the quarter mile in under 12 seconds. That thing was fast, and I think it set everybody back on their ear and took a look at everything, you know, hard, you know, over the next few decades. You know, the whole power-to-weight thing really got changed around there. And you know, noticing how, you know, RPMs and you know, pushing them up, you know, building an engine that didn't top out at 4,000 RPM, it was now finding its power up at 7,500. You know, it could combine power and speed at the same time, and, you know, was setting the performance world on its ear. You know, no doubt about it, you know. But these are all beautiful changes, man. These are all, you know, I'd love to see it. I really did. I mean, just to watch the technology in competition with each other, I thought was awesome. You know, I still do. You know, I'm still impressed by it. Like I say, look at the Fast and Furious movies. I am still totally impressed by those cars. Even the Tokyo Drift. I thought drifting was foolish when I tried it on a video game and other things, but when I saw what they were doing in that movie, I tell you what, that was pretty cool. All right, folks, we're at the top of the hour, and I've got to take a break here and then let our sponsors sell some of their goods. So we'll be right back. You're listening to the Politics Cafe at www.hernco.com and the ASI Radio Network being broadcast from Pal Talk, Politics Lobby for Secure Our Borders Voice Room. We'll be right back, folks.
Meeting new friends online can be hard to do at times. Chatting to complete strangers, showing cans with each other, and even sharing music. Can all this be done safely? No spyware, viruses attached to my computer. Absolutely. Pal Talk lets you chat, video cam, share music with family and friends, including free chat rooms where you can talk to each other about any topic that is on your mind. There is a category for everyone. Which one are you in? Find it on Pal Talk today. www.paltalk.com. www.paltalk.com.
In a time where good and evil have become completely distorted, one bright ray of light shines through. Politics Lobby 4. A modern-day battle of epic proportions. One light, many voices. Frontline with Kit Burke. The Politics Cafe with Mark Belcher. And the Extreme Four with Randy Wright. Good versus evil, light against dark, and fact versus fiction. Stay informed, arm yourself, and prepare for the battle. www.politicslobby4.com. Now is the time.
Hello, my friends. America, and indeed the world, has reached a crossroads in history. The global war on terror is real, and our servicemen and women, as well as their families, have felt it firsthand. This is why I, everyone's favorite self-appointed activist judge, Chief Justice Randy Wright, am inviting you to visit politicslobby4.com. That's www.politicslobby4.com. to show support for our troops. Join shows such as Frontline with Kit Gerald and the Politics Cafe. Remember, we're in this fight together. Thank you.
ASI. Audio. Are you ready? Video. Interactive. And you can catch it all. That's right. At ASI.
Thank you for joining us for the Politics Cafe. Join your host, Mark Belcher, every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Central Standard Time for the Politics Cafe, coming to you from politicslobby4.com and ASI Online.
And I believe we are back. You're listening to the Politics Cafe at www.hernco.com and the ASI Radio Network. Ah, folks, I'm sorry for everybody in the room that we started the bore by getting into car talk. I knew it was going to happen, but, you know, it's just one of them things. It's, what can I say? You know, this is why we want to fight for freedom in the world so that we can do these kind of things. We really do. I mean, let's face it, how much car talk are we going to be able to do? You know, we got to sit down five times a day and pray to Allah, you know, or try to figure out what that is under the burqa. You know what I mean? It's not going to happen yet. Yeah, I hear you, call bull. Yeah, no, it's not time to get started on NASCAR. Actually, we got to get back to the back to some politics here tonight, and I have just been informed that my buddy Bill here has got some audio clips from Mr. Bollinger today. And so, Mr. Wildwood and Mr. Hunter, I'm going to ask you to hang on there for a couple of seconds because I do want to get this back here. I'm still just going crazy. Just one. He's got one five-minute clip. Well, listen, tell you what there, Bill. I would love to hear that clip, and I would love to get back and talk about what's going on here today in the world, especially surrounding the events at Columbia University today. You know, I am amazed. I am amazed. So, without further ado, I'm going to ask my buddy Bill No Strings to come on up to the mic and play those clips for me.
Let me now turn to Mr. Ahmadinejad. First, on the brutal crackdown on scholars, journalists, and human rights advocates. Over the past 2 weeks, your government has released Dr. Hala Esfandieri and Parnas Agzima, and just 2 days ago, Kian Tagbash, a graduate of Columbia with a PhD in urban planning. While our community is relieved to learn of his release on bail, Dr. Tagbash remains in Tehran under house arrest, and he still does not know whether he will be charged with a crime or allowed to leave the country. Let me say this for the record. I call on the president today to ensure that Kian will be free to travel out of Iran as he wishes. Let me also report today that we are extending an offer to Kian to join our faculty as a visiting professor in urban planning here at his alma mater in our Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation, and we hope he will be able to join us next semester. The arrest and imprisonment of these Iranian Americans for no good reason is not only unjustified, it runs completely counter to the very values that allow today's speaker to even appear on this campus. But at least they are alive. According to Amnesty International, 210 people have been executed in Iran so far this year, 21 of them on the morning of September 5th alone. This annual total includes at least two children, further proof, as Human Rights Watch puts it, that Iran leads the world in executing minors. There is more. Iran hanged up to 30 people this past July and August during a widely reported suppression of efforts to establish a more democratic society. Many of these executions were carried out in public view, a violation of the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights to which Iran is a party. These executions and others have coincided with a wider crackdown on student activists and academics accused of trying to foment a so-called soft revolution. This has included jailing and forced retirement of scholars. As Dr. Esfandieri said in a broadcast interview since her release, she was held in solitary confinement for 105 days because the government believes that the United States is planning a velvet revolution in Iran. In this very room, last year we learned something about velvet revolutions from Václav Havel, and we will likely hear the same from our World Leaders Forum speaker this evening, President Michelle Bachelet of Chile. Both of their extraordinary stories remind us that there are not enough prisons to prevent an entire society that wants its freedom from achieving it. We at this university have not been shy to protest the challenge and challenge the failures of our own government to live by our values, and we won't be shy about criticizing yours. Let's then be clear at the beginning. Mr. President, you exhibit all the signs of a petty and cruel dictator. And so I ask you, why have women, members of the Baha'i faith, homosexuals, and so many of our academic colleagues become targets of persecution in your country? Why, in a letter last week to the Secretary General of the UN, did Akbar Ghanji, Iran's leading political dissident, and over 300 public intellectuals, writers and Nobel laureates expressed such grave concern that your inflamed dispute with the West is distracting the world's attention from the intolerable conditions in your regime within Iran, in particular the use of the press law to ban writers for criticizing the ruling system? Why are you so afraid of Iranian citizens expressing their opinions for change? In our country, you are interviewed by our press and asked to speak here today. And while my colleagues at the law school, Michael Dorf, one of my colleagues, spoke to Radio Free Europe viewers in Iran a short while ago on the tenets of freedom of speech in this country, I propose further that you let me lead a delegation of students and faculty from Columbia to address your universities about free speech with the same freedom we afford you today. Secondly, the denial of the Holocaust. In a December 2005 state television broadcast, you described the Holocaust as a fabricated legend. 1 year later, you held a two-day conference of Holocaust deniers. For the illiterate and ignorant, this is dangerous propaganda. When you have come to a place like this, this makes you quite simply ridiculous. You are either brazenly provocative or astonishingly uneducated. You should know...
Wow. That was awesome. Yeah, I'll tell you what. You know, this is a guy... That could have been me. It could have been me. Although I got to admit, I didn't know about half of those things that were going on in Iran. I'll be honest with you. Shows how much I've been keeping up with things over the last few weeks with this wedding coming up. But, yeah, I'll tell you, folks, that man took him to task there. You know? It was great. It was really great. All right, Hunter, you got to add 2 cents about this. Mike is yours, bud.
No, I'm going to go ahead and pass it. Go ahead, Wild. I'm sorry. I tried to take my hand down. I'm just at total awe over this. It disturbs me to no end. I can't comment about it without getting frustrated and swearing, put it that way.
Go ahead there, Wildwood.
Will do. Thank you very much. You know, I was against him coming here and speaking to them students in that school. But there was, in fact, a point made about that. And one of the biggest points that I heard made about that, why it was a positive aspect for him to be able to, for him to be there and ask questions like that, was to give the students the ability to experience international forum
firsthand.
Okay, I can deal with that. But the silver lining to this whole event is the fact that even on our ground, it is known firsthand by those students and the rest of the world in this country who all has paid attention rather than turning their back on it without at least looking at it, realize firsthand what we are dealing with in some of our foreign leaderships, if you will. So, and of course, with that being the case, Ahmadinejad was shown to be exactly what he is. And I'm sure that everybody here understands what I'm saying there. Go ahead.
Yep, brutal little dictator. Exactly. Although I'll tell you, and I've maintained a position right from the get-go, he's just a mouth for the dictator. The dictator is the Ayatollah Khomeini. As simple as that. You know, he is there. And Ahmadinejad has basically bowed his knee to the ruling clergy over there. You know, he represents them to the people. It ain't the other way around. Dark Wolf, you got your hand up. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying in the room about the fact that Ahmadinejad has actually met with an anti-Zionist Jewish group. I saw it on Fox News. I don't know where it happened. I'm assuming it happened somewhere in New York. But he, there was like a video of him like kissing these like Orthodox Jewish people wearing like the Orthodox Jewish dress, and it seemed like a bizarre like image. It was a bizarre situation because again, you know, it'd be the equivalent of Hitler circa 1933, you know, going up and meeting an anti Jewish cause group in Germany. I mean, it's just a very, very bizarre situation. I mean, the whole, in general, the whole Ahmadinejad situation is, you know, despicable. I mean, I'm of the opinion that he should be allowed in and then allowed to say what he wants, just to the UN. I mean, I personally would have been completely against, you know, he wanted to go to the Twin Tower sites, he wanted to go to the 9/11 memorial. I mean, immediately, in my opinion, I said, absolutely not. There's no way you're going anywhere near it. And I don't think he probably should have been invited to Colombia. But if he had been, then, you know, again, I would have kept his ability to spew his propaganda. He's allowed to do that once, then what's happened, and I'd say the same thing for the UN. He's allowed to say what he has to say, then he's countered. His insane theories are exposed for the paranoid ramblings of a delusional pseudo-dictator that he is. And, you know, then he's ridiculed and sidelined. I've said this before, that's the way I would have dealt with him in a situation. I think that, you know, he uses these events as a platform, as a soapbox, to spew his, you know, his rhetoric. And, you know, again, like most other people, when I listened to Lee Bollinger and his pre-speech before Ahmadinejad took to the stage, I was amazed at how aggressive he was. And I was actually saying, you know, yeah, that's some of the things he was saying, that's awesome. But at the same time, you know, I think maybe Bollinger was only saying those things because he was pushed into it. Either way, whatever he was saying, you know, whatever reason he was saying it, it was right. He deserved to be rightly ridiculed on the stage like he was. I mean, basically, Lee Bollinger was calling him Hitler, which I found, you know, awesome. Because, again, it's pretty much true. This is a guy that likes to enact very, very similar policies to Hitler. And, you know, how Ahmadinejad could even get on the stage and say that America is not enacting freedom of speech by allowing him to say things and complaining that he was attacked, when in his country, people that want the same things, that want the same rights that he's abusing in America, are either in prison or executed. I mean, just the sheer hypocrisy. So, yeah, you know, I understand what you're saying, Hunter. I get annoyed thinking about someone like him and the fact that he, you know, he's trying to abuse and trying to make a mockery of our freedoms, you know, that he obviously doesn't want for his own people. But, you know, that's what he does. It's a game that he likes to play. So, yeah, my personal opinion is he should have been invited to the UN. He's allowed to say his piece, then he's countered, his points are destroyed, and then he's sidelined and ridiculed. That's the way I would have liked to have dealt with it.
Well put. Well put. All right. Deb from Australia. I see you're up and around here. Well, I guess it's early morning out there, isn't it? At any rate, the mic is all yours, kiddo.
Yeah, it's 11:19 a.m. on Tuesday morning in Australia. And I would just like to say how very pleased I was to have the dean of the university, the Columbian University, University of Columbia, Mr. Bollinger, on our news this morning. Now, sorry, I'm reading the room, and that's the wrong thing to do. I should say Columbia University. I think it's just wonderful that he did what he did. I do realize that some people are already upset that he didn't do enough, didn't go far enough, and some people have, I believe he's even been attacked for attacking Mr. Ahmadinejad's freedom of speech. You know, there's something really wrong with that picture when the likes of Ward Churchill get away with what they get away with, and Michael Moore are invited to universities to preach their to teach their lies and hate, and Mr. Bollinger is touted as is given a bad time about what he did. I personally think that he should be thanked by the American people. I think that he should be lauded for his courage, because when you're looking at what the very vast majority of his peers are like, I think that he does stand out as at least having, and if I'm allowed to say it, the kahunas, to begin to take this little fellow on. I think it's a wonderful thing that Columbia University are able to have speakers such as Ahmadinejad. I doubt very much, however, that there will be a reversed invitation afforded Mr. Bollinger to Iran. And I think that in itself speaks volumes. Would you not agree? Either way, I think there's a time that and the time is now that we just remind people who have such vulnerable people in their charge as young students, as the future generations of your nation and mine, that they are to present things without personal bias, that they are to allow healthy debate and encourage people's thinking and making up of their own decisions, as opposed to trying to influence them about their own choices in life. It's an age-old adage for a teacher, and how do I know? Because I am one. Is that you're to present issues without personal bias and allow for a variety of viewpoints. You're not to impose your personal beliefs. And in particular, what I find saddest of all that I've witnessed is that the students' grades at times depend on the students' political opinion, and that's wrong. That is not what university education is all about. I think when you have a bit of a look too, clearly the studies show that there are far more, or a significant number more, left-wing professors and instructors and university-related teachers than there are right-wing, and I think that's a negative influence in your country, and I believe it's becoming a negative influence in mine. You see, they have stereotypical thinking. They're beyond, in many ways, conventional wisdom when it comes to just presenting the situation. Berkeley University, I shake my head. You know, they have so much of your nation's and my nation's wonderful potential in their surrounds. And what are they doing with it? They're twisting it and they're turning it into what I believe are not necessarily positive avenues. But anyway, that's just my opinion. I just want to step up to the plate, if I may, and say that I think it's wonderful. Oops, and 1 minute. I didn't know the rule. I do apologize. I very much apologize. Sorry, Bibi.
Yeah, not a problem, Deb. It's always good to hear from you. You had made the point there that you would like to see that invitation extended back. And actually, Ahmadinejad did that. Said he would welcome all the students that wanted to come over there and speak to the university people, that there were 400 universities. He would give them a list. And that was the part that caught me. He gave me a list of what's left after he closed them all down. Yeah, I don't forget we had the Iranian dissident that we interviewed in this room back in the spring, who went right through. And that was Ahmadinejad's first move, Ahmadinejad. His first move after taking office was to clean out the colleges. Went through and grabbed all the conservatives and all what he considered the liberals, liberal professors, and fired them. Bang, and they were replaced with people loyal to the Islamic cause. No hands down, you know. Most of these people were clerics that took over the teaching positions there. And Mr. Bollinger obviously pointed that right out to the man and said, you know, what's going on here? You're basically persecuting education in your country and rigging it. Not a good thing. Not a good thing. You know, well, you got to remember, too, Deb, that all these liberals out there do believe that they're giving all sides of the equation, you know. The thing about it is they already believe that people are well indoctrinated with the conservative side of things. And in order for them to balance the world, they have to indoctrinate the other way. which, you know, at this point in time, since they've been indoctrinating the other way for so long, that that's all the kids are getting, and they're getting it right from the get-go, right from grade school on up. It's a bad thing. But you want to know why those people are in there? And I'm convinced of this. The whole reason that they become teachers is because it's the only way they'll ever be able to fulfill their power trip dreams. You know, half of a liberal's motivation to do what he does is because he needs that power. He's looking down at the rest of us as being stupid, and because he feels that he is smarter than everyone else, he feels that he is obligated to take control. You know, whether they're doing this just out of a greed for power, or a hunger for power, or the total need to bring order out of what they see as chaos, it makes no difference. In the end of it, they're looking to seize power. It's always been that way, and that's why they go to schools, because they're not going to get power any other way. They want to go out in the real world and produce real goods and real services. They're going to have to work. And all of a sudden, they're going to find out that then they don't have any power. They have to deal with each other as equals. You know, you've got to make agreements with people at that point, or else nothing at all gets done. You know, quite simply put, that nobody's going to do anything for you without you coming through and doing something for them. You know, they find out that when you get out in the real world, it's a two-way street. They don't have the one-way street where they get to dictate the terms anymore. So, of course, they're going to, you know, retreat to the halls of academia where, you know, you can just tell a kid to sit down and shut up and put whatever mark you want on his paper for whatever it is he turns in, for whatever reasons you've got to give, and period. You know, they're bang, they're in control, they're feeling secure, untouchable, happy, you know. Well, I don't know about happy, but I don't know if they ever really understand what happiness is. You know, these are people that you got to understand have always confused pleasure with joy, and still to this day don't see any difference between the two of them. Ah, but I digress. Deep Water, PTE, your hand is up, and the mic is yours.
Thank you very much. I think I've posted it a couple times, but I don't agree that he should have been able to speak, but I also really strongly believe that Bollinger was so pointedly rude, which is insane to me, because when you invite someone to any event, you always treat them with kindness. I don't care if it's a cocktail party, if it's a high school graduation, if it's your little kid's birthday party, you do not insult a guest. And I think that the pressure was put on him so much that they are going to lose so much funding from the Alumni Association, and their endowments will go down, that he had to do that. It's very simple. It's follow the money. And that's what he did, what he had to do. He had to make sure that he secured the endowment fund.
Well, everybody's entitled to their opinion. I don't think he was rude at all. I think he was calling a spade a spade. You know, it's I'm sorry. I don't think there was any rudeness there. Rudeness would have been a whole lot worse. Would have snubbed it. To be rude to the guy would have been to snub him. Nah, I don't think so. But hey, like I said, you're entitled to your opinion. Dark Wolf, your hand is up. Go right ahead.
Thanks, man. While I agree, Deep War, that if you're gonna invite someone to your home or to your university or to, you know, your forum, I agree that it can seem a little bit rude maybe to then abuse them, or at least lay into them. While I agree on that, the fact is, it's Ahmadinejad, and because of that fact, he deserves what Bollinger gave him, and so much more, in my opinion. So I agree that, yeah, maybe a little bit rude, but it was rudeness that was warranted, in my opinion. I think that Ahmadinejad, when I first started watching, I caught the first half of the speech, and I was listening to Bollinger's pre-speech, and I was thinking the stuff and the things that he was saying. You know, they were so poignant, and they made so much sense. I don't know much about this Lee Bollinger guy. Personally, again, I think he may have made a mistake in inviting him anyway. But he did invite him. And then when he laid into him, I completely agree with everything he said, and I was thinking this is a good thing. And again, while I agree with you that, yeah, it was maybe slightly rude, the fact is, in my opinion, it's rudeness that was warranted. And it was warranted along with so much more. Amadeen Jad deserves to be, as I said before, in my opinion, roundly criticized. You know, allow him to speak his, shine a light on his psychosis and his ramblings and his rantings, and let everyone see exactly what this guy is, how bad this guy is, how deluded and dangerous this guy is, and then defeat his arguments in the open, then ridicule him and sideline him. I mean, that would be my tactic of dealing with him. But you know, before you get off the mic, the one thing I was saying in the room before, it never fails to stun and amaze me how the radical fascist fundamentalist portion of Islam is able and has been able to win the media war and convince, you know, leftist, secular Westerners to fight on its behalf. How that section of Islam has been able to convince these Western, you know, atheists, most of the time liberals, to fight for it is always stunned me. And I mean, in a way, it is a stroke of evil genius how they've been able to convince these basically patsies to fight on its behalf, even though if the fundamentalists, imams and mullahs, had their way, they would either have these people converted to a religion that they hate, or you know, beheaded, or executed or imprisoned. But yeah, I mean, I'm amazed how they would do that. And it seemed like Ahmadinejad today was trying to again play the media card, trying to play up to the cameras, trying to convince people that he's really not that bad. You know, he's an academic. He's just misunderstood. People just don't understand him. And yeah, I thought it was amazing. Obviously, you know, the guy is a joke, and he's dangerous. And you know, most of what he said today was either distorting the issues or sidestepping them. But yeah, again, I mean, how they've been able to really convince so many people in the Western world that they're really not the bad guys, that Bush in America and the West is actually the bad guy. Yeah, it amazes me. It does stun me. But yeah, you know, on the issue of Ahmadinejad, I think you know, he's been seen now. He said what he had to say. His arguments now should be countered. He should, you know, they should be destroyed, and then he should be sidelined and ridiculed again. That's my opinion on it.
All right, I'll tell you why they coddle each other the way they do. Well, because in the end they get the same goal: world collectivism. Hey, no doubt about it in my mind whatsoever. None. You know, they want a strong central government that rules by force. They think that's the only way in the world that they are going to ever achieve what they call order in this world. Let me tell you something. Most of these liberals over here, you don't hear them putting down Islam or so much of that at all. And the reason being was, let me tell you something. Just suppose that the Muslims came here en masse and decided to either kill or convert every one of us. Now, let me tell you something. The liberals in this country, you right up to the front, hands unfolded, here, give me my burqa, give me my hat, give me my turban, give me my prayer rug, I'll be there. No problem. They will submit in a heartbeat. In a cold-blooded heartbeat, any liberal will get right up there. A, to save his own skin, and B, to think he might, you know, after he proves that he is a worthy one, to be put in charge of something. You know, he will be the best Muslim you ever saw, just so that he can try to be in charge of something and go right back to the old power grab that I was saying before. You know, but they have the same MO. You know, make no mistake about it. The socialists of the world, the communists, the fascists, the Islamo-fascists, these are all just facets of collectivism. You know, that same ugly stone that has been mankind's oldest enemy. No doubt about it. You know, diametrically opposed to the individualism that has made this country what it is. You know, that has shown people the light of freedom. And there's, you know, that's what it's all about. You know, they do not like this. As far as you are, as far as they're concerned, when you are free, you are out of their control and something to be feared. And that's just the way they look at it. They are afraid, and it is all based on fear. You know, that's why I say these people, you know, they make no, make no difference between joy and pleasure. They don't understand the joy of sitting down and creating something with your hands and then trading it with someone else willingly and happily, and making a new friend out of a trading partner, someone that you can view as an equal. You know, someone who can come up and trade to you their goods and services and who will purchase your goods and services. You know, and where you both walk away richer than you did before, you know what I mean? A mutual profit by mutual agreement. Make friends that way. You know, I mean, I look at what goes on around here. You know, liberals all try to help each other out. Yeah, well, you know, it's a fine thing, and I have a problem with that. And, you know, the conservatives are pretty much the same way. But, you know, for the most part, the conservatives around here, you know, somebody comes over and helps you out with something, you pay him for his time. You go over and help him out with something, he'll pay you for his time. And don't just say, oh, glad to help you out, you don't owe me anything. We will always say that, but the fact of the matter is, you know, if somebody does something for me, hey, I'm going to throw him a couple bucks. I'm going to buy him dinner, or I'm going to, you know, or at least give him the same amount of time performing the services that I do for him. The best part about it is we call this trade, you know. It's a beautiful thing, and I have very close friends this way. And they're good friends. And you know what really keeps them good friends? The fact that they can still come over, you still have a beer, still sit down and watch a game, still go out and play golf and everything. And nobody owes anything to anybody. You know, all our debts are settled, which is why you can be friends in the free and clear. It's a beautiful thing. Libs ought to try it sometime. Wildwood, you got your hand up. Go right ahead.
Thank you, BB. The reason why I keyed up is I wanted to key up and respond to... Deepwater? You know, I don't understand why, if something is happening and it is a less than positive type of a situation, why people need to be so generous in being in conversation with those that are, how do I say, causing havoc. I really don't believe that that guy at the college was wrong in the questioning that he posed to Ahmadinejad, or how he posted the questions. And I do believe that it was good. And the reason why I say that is because if you cannot at least voice your opinion and ask hard questions and, I don't know, push back an aggressor, the aggressor is going to think that, well, they're on the right track and they're going to keep on pushing the way that they are and they're going to overcome you. And they think that they're going to have an easy job of it. Now, what happened today is, you know, I believe could have been a little bit more positive. In other words, it would have made the Ahmadinejad think a little bit harder and take a little bit of information back to his, I'm going to call it his boss, and let them know that they're dealing with something that, you know, those Americans are not so easy to push around. In the way that it seems to others, is it is easy to push us around. I mean, you know, we're seeing that, and we have been seeing that for quite some time. We have in fact been called a paper tiger by many out of that part of the world, and I don't know. I just have to disagree with you. I think that cold hard questions have to be asked. I think cold hard statements have to be stated in order for two different sides to be able to understand what is really on the table here.
Well, my opinion is I can't believe some of the things I'm hearing. I really can't. Everybody's in here trying to act above it all. Turn on the TV and it's a debate. Should we give Ahmadinejad freedom of speech? And how strongly can we condemn him with the most Baroque and Rococo words we can dream of? This guy is a killer. He's killing your soldiers. He's killing your sons and daughters. An attack on our soldiers is an attack on us. And we're in here debating whether this guy is anti-gay or pro-gay, whether he should have free speech. This is a load of crap. This is why 9/11's happened. American people have been beaten down into submission to let a killer walk among us free. We are responsible for this guy because we have this panty-waist, sissified policy of no political assassinations. We should strap a transmitter to this guy and we should bomb him anytime we get. I don't have any beef with the Iranian people. I don't want to destroy their country. But this guy is the poster child for political assassination if there ever was one. He's killing your soldiers. Let me repeat that. He's killing your soldiers. And you invite him to a semi-prestigious university, was prestigious till the other day, and we're going to talk to him like he's some fellow intellectual, a man of ideas, a man of thoughts. He's a man of guns, a man of violence. He's an animal of crime. And everybody in America who's out there grabbing international TV time trying to act so above it all and intellectual should be ashamed of yourselves. They ought to have a $50 million bounty on this guy's head, just like Osama bin Laden. He's worse. And we're all treating him like some kind of intellectual. Like if we just say the right words to him, he's going to go back and change his policy. This guy is a Ted Bundy. Kill him. Mark him for political assassination. I can't believe the gobbledygook I'm hearing from coast to coast, all this pseudo-intellectual crap. My God, people, wake up. He's a serial killer, a mass murderer, and he should have a target on his head, and that's it. Oh, I've ranted enough. You can have the mic, Hunter.
Worthwhile rant there, Fly. Yeah, worthwhile. And I'll tell you what, you have echoed the statements of a lot of people's thoughts, and no doubt about it. No doubt, and I tell you something, you can't gainsay what you said there. The man is a murderous thug. No doubt about it. But, you know, hey, we were just putting him mild there. Mr. Bollinger was just putting him mildly, and we called him a petty and cruel dictator. But petty and cruel is exactly what he is. Yeah, no doubt about it. He hit the nail right on the head, though. Well, like I said before, I just didn't want to see anyone over here make a martyr out of the guy for his own cause. It would have just been totally antithetical to our cause. As much as I would love to see the guy in the ground pushing up daisies where he belongs, you know, I did not want to see our agenda set back and further his agenda by one of us putting a bullet in him. I really didn't. You know, as much as he deserves it, there's no doubt about it. You know, I just, man, you know, to make a martyr out of the guy would have set us back 30 years. No doubt. Wildwood, Mike is yours.
Wait a minute. That I keyed up and I lost my hand. Actually, if you want to go ahead and take a look at the full scenario picture on what is going on. Now, this is my theory and my theory only. Well, at one time we were right on. We liked Saddam Hussein. We enjoyed the hell out of him. We were giving. No, I didn't. All right, fine. I won't.
No, he didn't either there, Amber. But, Hunter, stay on the line there, please. Don't worry about it. Not a big deal.
I hate someone not paying attention. I cannot stand it. So just let her be. Let it go. I'll do it next time.
All right, well, stay right in line there. Wildwood, the mic is yours.
Well, I would have preferred for Hunter to go ahead and come right back up because I knew that he was there. That's why I didn't key up, and I knew what happened. And I agree with him anyway. But, you know, the thing of it is, Bibi, you said it very well. You know, the worst thing we could have done, that we could do, is kill or arrest him after he has, in fact, been invited to the country. Okay, or I should say allowed to come here for that forum. I don't, you know, although I would have liked to seen him hung, it's still the wrong thing to do. It would damage our efforts. The thing of it is, if you know, let's put it this way, during battle, okay, every now and then there is going to be some verbal discourse between the leaders of the two battling factions. Okay, and that is in fact a good thing because sometimes it helps to draw the battle to an end. It helps to stop more deaths. Now, granted, this time, you know, this thing here that happened today is not one of them kind of situations, but still, you don't, you know, it wouldn't have been the right thing to do. Okay, the right thing to do, I think, would have been to go ahead and disallow him to be here. But with the way things played out, he came, he done what he done, he said what he had to say, he was shown to be the, how do I put it, the one who does not like to answer questions or whatever, that he is. Yes, liar. Thank you, Lesh. I was trying to put it without using the word, but that's the word that I was getting to. So, you know, the best thing to do is let him go back home, and if battle ensues, you know, just make sure that he's one of the first that is in the sights of the weapon. I mean, that way, you know, it would be less likely that he would be looked at as a martyr, number one. It's understandable, the frustration that we have. I am very, very frustrated about it as well. But anyway, I wish Hunter would have stayed up here. I would have liked to let him finish what he had to say. Anyway, I'm done.
All right, Hunter, Hunter will come back up, I'm sure. Dark Wolf, mic is yours.
I was just going to respond to Fly Over Space. I agree with, I think it was Wild, who was on before, who was saying that to kill Anna DNJ would have just made him martyr. Or it might have been BB, I'm not sure, but I agree with the person that was saying that. To kill Ahmadi and Jeb, once we've invited him to this country, would have simply made him a martyr, and would have done nothing to quell the anger and the, you know, the almost confirmation that we have in Iraq and the Middle East area. And if anything, it would have made things worse. So I don't see how that would have served our purposes. I mean, like, let's face it, we all pretty much know that Ahmadi and Jeb is a puppet. He's told what to do by Khomeini, and he's ruled pretty much by the imams and the mullahs of Iran. I mean, I think most people know that that's the situation as I understand it. And to kill him would have simply been to not only would it have been they'd have just replaced him, so they wouldn't have done anything on that issue. But it also would have highlighted to the world, well, all the foreign leaders who are hostile to America and the West. If they come to America, then they're going to get shot. And again, that does nothing for America's image and public opinion on the world stage. And it does nothing really to solve the problems. Because again, if this guy's killed, then just replace him with another one. Because you're not taking out the head of the serpent, as it were. You're simply, you know, shooting one guy who will simply then be replaced. I don't think that would have done anything. Plus, again, the fact is he wasn't like he just turned up in the country. He was invited, and he was going to the UN. I don't think technically and even politically it could have been done with any kind of expediency. I disagree with you. I mean, this is the thing. I think the guy is horrific, and I think he should be taken out of power. I personally think he should be in prison. But at this point in time, killing him in a political assassination, I don't think would have achieved any goals, really, except to the detriment of the Western world and America in the specific sense. So, you know, the guy is horrific. As I said before, my opinion is on this matter is this. He should be, you know, let him speak his insane babbling ranting. Let him highlight and show himself as the, you know, crazy little freak that he is. Then denounce him, destroy his ideas, destroy his ideology, then sideline him, ridicule him, and then make him irrelevant. That's the way I think it should be dealt. I think that's the best way to deal with the situation. I think it's the most expedient way to deal with the situation. I think that would enable us to achieve our goals, and possibly even reduce the influence of Iran in Iraq. to highlight and shame and ridicule him and make him look like a little idiot that he is, I think that's going to do far more good than a bullet between the eyes. For our cause, anyway. And I understand the impulse to want to, you know, punish him for the fact that he's supplying arms and logistics and men to fight our soldiers in Iraq. I understand that. I understand the instinct to want to take him out. But yet, again, it has to be thought of rationally, logically, and reasonably. And I think that highlighting him for the idiot that he is on a world stage will do more good for our forces and for our countries than putting a bullet straight between his eyes. I think that's the situation as it stands.
Thanks. And it was, you know, I'll tell you, there was one small point you made in there that really ties it all together there. You know, and it's the one point that the liberals completely miss, totally and altogether. You know, as if you said, you know, you take him out, you're not cutting off the head of the snake, he would be replaced. And when most of the liberals out there just do not seem to understand that the head of the snake does not reside in any one person in the Middle East. It does not reside in the Ayatollah Khomeini. It does not reside in Osama bin Laden. It does not reside in al-Zarqawi. It resides in the head of every single Muslim that is following that ideology. The head of the snake is the ideology itself. That's the problem here. You know, a good friend that I have yet to see in these rooms, and I know at some point he's going to make his way through here, is an Australian. Bit of a socialist himself. But he said something very, very important once, the fact is here, look, you know, it's one thing to go out there and fight another person. It's another thing entirely to go out there and fight an idea. And that is what's going on here. It's the idea that they can run all the world. It's the idea that Islam is the only way to rule the world. It's the idea that Islam is the only way to find their peace that they want. It's the only way to run an ordered society. It's that idea that resides in the head of every single one of those fanatical Muslims that has got to be cut off. Now, you can cut off all their heads, but you make martyrs out of them, and you're only going to reinforce that idea in those that might be sitting on the fence. The point is, you have to replace the idea. And you have to replace the idea, any idea of collectivism, with the idea of liberty and with the idea of freedom. You have to promote that liberty. Okay? Once that liberty gets established, prosperity comes right behind it. And trust me, once people are prosperous, religion takes a back seat. Any ideas of collectivism take a back seat. If you all of a sudden find yourself with an opportunity to make your way through the world, okay, you will seize that opportunity if you are free to seize that opportunity. All of us will do that. Any human being, I'm convinced of this. You know, George Bush even said that inside of everybody is that spirit that longs to be free. And once it finds that freedom, nothing stands in the way. And that is what it's all about. So you can't, it's a very good point you made there, Dark Hudson. You know, the head of that snake is not, you know, resting in any one person's head. All right, Fly, I took up some of your space there, my friend. The mic is all yours. Thanks for waiting.
Well, thank you there. I always like listening to my fellow chatters, but I still cannot believe what I'm hearing. In the last 10 minutes, I've heard about Ahmadinejad the victim, Ahmadinejad the poor misunderstood intellectual. I don't believe any of it. I don't agree with any of it. Not only do I not agree with it, I think you're categorically wrong, all of you. This guy is not a victim. He is a killer. He's killed our soldiers. I don't want to invite him here and take him out with a sniper rifle. He should have never been here in the first place. This is not the 1938 Olympics, and we don't know what kind of monster Hitler's going to turn into. This guy has been an international criminal for 20 years, for most of his life. He's a career criminal. And he's a terrorist. And I have to listen to words like horrific. Well, let me go to my thesauruses and see if I can find a stronger word than horrific, and I'll use it in a letter, a strongly worded letter, and send it to the New York Times, and maybe that will change Ahmadinejad. We're not going to get Islam out of the Middle East overnight, but we can get rid of Ahmadinejad. The guy is a criminal, a nut. Have you listened to him? Did you listen to him? This guy is mentally ill. He's like Kim Jong-il. and we are in this impotent nation with this Jimmy Carter-esque no political assassination crap. And it's everybody else has to pay the price for it because we don't have leaders who will drop a bomb on this guy's head. Over there in Iran, don't invite him here to New York. He should have been allowed to leave the country the minute he left Iranian airspace. They should have downed his plane with F-15s and carried him away in handcuffs. That would send a message. All this gobbledygook that we let him talk and we're going to work this thing out. The only image the world needs to see of Ahmadinejad is walking away in handcuffs in a striped uniform going to some kind of world prison somewhere in Europe or the U.S. or Gitmo. That's the only place we should have invited Ahmadinejad is to Gitmo. That's the only place he belongs. And I can't believe this country that I live in lets the serial murder of our innocent freedom-fighting soldiers walk around. If I was a soldier over there in Iraq, I'd say, what is this country gone nuts? The Constitution is now a suicide pact. Well, we're just going to give this killer a poor...
All right, Fly, I had to step on you there, man. None of us are saying that. We really aren't. You know, and every single one of us here wants to see that guy pushing up daisies just as bad as you. You know, I'm sorry. You know, Grace, you're a good friend of mine. I hate to dot people like that. But, man, none of us here is going down that road of coddling this guy. You know, or inviting him over here to talk to him or anything else. I mean, let's face it. We were all in the same boat as you as far as this. You know, and as far as jumping in there and taking out the Iranians, we're just waiting for the time to be right here, my friend. Now, we do not have three carrier groups sitting in the Persian Gulf right now for absolutely no reason. You know, there are, I'm sure, some politics going on here that I think is unwarranted. I'm with you as far as I'm concerned, at this point in time, most of Iran should be a sea of glass. Should be nothing but craters and sand that's been blown into glass, and no doubt about it. You know, but yeah, I don't know, maybe it's the little liberal part of me that's sitting here and saying, I just don't want to take out innocent people. But somewhere in the back of my mind, you know, that there are people over there that want to live in freedom. George Bush wants to give these people a chance to live in freedom first. I think it's what we're all doing, basically, is giving them that last chance to live in freedom first. You know, now, Ahmadinejad, and no doubt about everything you said there, the man is a criminal. He's a piece of shit. And there, I said it, and I broke G tonight in my own room tonight. And there's no doubt about it. You know, no doubt about it whatsoever. But fact of the matter is, man, we just cannot, even that, I still got no problem with sending a sniper over there to take a bullet out. I really don't. I just didn't want to see it happen here while he's here in this country. You know what I mean? There's no sense in lowering ourselves to their level of doing business and expecting to win this show in the long run. You know what I mean? It's just the way it is. You know? All right, I'm sorry. I'm definitely going to take the top back off you. Dark, you got the mic.
Thanks. Yeah, again, just to reiterate, Fly, I don't think anyone here was saying that Ahmadinejad is a victim or that, you know, he's misunderstood. I mean, I was saying that as the liberal talking points, but obviously I was saying in a sarcastic way. No one in this room is saying that Ahmadinejad, you know, deserves anything less than prison. Like, we want to see him killed and, you know, assassinated, you know, in a political assassination. I personally want to see the guy, you know, in prison, out of power and ridiculed. But again, no one's saying that, you know, this guy is a victim. So I don't quite know where you're coming from. You know, most people in this room, I think, are in agreement that, you know, he's a dangerous, psychotic little man who has delusions of religious zealotry about this imam that sits on his shoulder and tells him what to do. The guy is psychopathic, and I think, yeah, as someone said in the room, he is a sociopath. He, the way he speaks and the normalcy that he conveys and the calmness, despite the fact that he's often talking about wiping a entire people off the face of the earth. I mean, you know, that pretty much is a classic definition of a sociopath. Aside from being a psychopath, I think, you know, the guy is dangerous. So I think we're all on the same page on that. And no one's saying that, you know, that he's caught. I personally think it would probably be a mistake to invite him to to Columbia University. I think that it's as much as we can, we should be denying him the ability to showcase and to grandstand for the cameras and for the world media. But when that does happen, I think what should happen is that he says his piece, he's then roundly discredited, he's shown to be, you know, the psychotic little midget that he is, and then from that point, he's ridiculed on the sidelines. I've said this before many times, but I think that's the best way to go in this. I think that would do far more good for our countries, and it would make him far less more powerful than if he was turned into a martyr by putting a bullet between his eyes. That's all I was saying. And again, I think I'd much prefer him to be alive and less powerful and not able to harm our troops, rather than dead and as a martyr inspire thousands more to attack our troops. I guess that's what I was trying to say. So, you know, if you still got the wrong end of the stick, you know, I'm sorry about that, but you know, I didn't, and no one else in here, I think, intended to say that, you know, he was a victim, because he obviously isn't. He's a dangerous, psychotic little zealot, and you know, he needs to be sidelined as soon as possible. Aside from that, I think, you know, I think it's a, you know, the whole situation with him coming over, it's a situation where I probably wouldn't have liked. Again, no one here was saying that he should have been invited. You know, none of us said that he should have been invited into the UN. You know, again, I don't know whether he necessarily should have been given any kind of platform to speak. But the fact is, he is a leader of a foreign country. Hostile though it may be, he is still the leader of that country. And I don't think you can simply, you know, just ignore someone that's the leader of a country, especially when we are involved in negotiations with them. So I think there has to be some kind of dialogue. There has to be some kind of ability to communicate. You know, the level of that, I guess, can be debated.
All right, we've got about 30 seconds here to wrap this up here. You know, while I would make it quick, I definitely want to give Fly a last word here. Fly, sorry I had a red dye. I just wanted you to understand, you know, that none of us in here are mollycoddling this guy. You know, none whatsoever. You know, we want to see, I'd like to see him dead just as quick as you. Personally, the political assassination in his own country, I don't have a problem with that. You know what I mean? It's one of the points that I think Kerry was almost right on. You know, covert operations to take out people in other countries, got no problem with that. You know, none. But go ahead, Wildwood, please, keep it short, and Fly, keep it short. I've got to wrap this up here. We're running over time.
Okay, there we go. Well, you know, I keep on hearing people saying that they would just soon go ahead and go over there and make that whole place a glass parking lot. I sometimes agree with that. As a matter of fact, most of the time when I'm not thinking correctly, I agree with that. But we have to stop and realize there are quite a few people over there that are actually working toward breaking down the leadership of Iran as well, from within their own country. Okay, and you know, maybe that might help. I don't know, but exactly, take him out, not the whole country. Take the leadership out, not the whole country. That's the way I see it, because there are a lot of good people over there. Although they have their beliefs in Islam, I don't believe that everybody that believes in Islam believes that the infidel needs to be killed. There's other people that think that the infidel is within, and that's who you have to destroy. Is the infidel within? Next.
Well, I guess I'll get the last couple of seconds. Good news, I just sent Ahmadinejad a letter where I referred to him as monstrous evil and he resigned. Sorry, that's not going to happen, folks. I don't mean to insult any of you, but I'm disgusted that this guy was given a forum, the killer of our soldiers, and all we're inviting is war through weakness. I don't want to do anything to the country of Iran and their people, but if there was ever a poster child for legal, warranted political assassination, this guy earns the gold medal. And like I said, if we're going to invite him over here, well, heck, we might as well invite Bin Laden too. You out there, Osama Bin Laden? Maybe you can come to Duke University or something, and you know, we can use strongly worded language against you too. This is utterly crazy. I respect your opinion, and I guess I'm the last one to talk tonight, and I just wish one of our soldiers would be over there and take him out. And I think political assassination should be the occupational hazard of nutcases. This guy is over the top mentally ill. He's not a legitimate anything just because he won an election. Chavez wins election. You're going to call him legitimate? This guy's a murderer, a nutcase, and he's trying to get nuclear weapons. He's foaming at the mouth to get nuclear weapons, and we're inviting him to talk and think we're going to change his mind with strongly worded statements. Good night, all. Enjoy talking.
All right. Thanks a lot, Fly. Now, you're right. You know, I mean, I'm not going to disagree with you on that point. You know, the man does have to go. But he's not the only one that's got to go here. You know, that whole ideology has just got to get replaced. You know, I really thought that a long time ago that, just the fact that Israel, the democracy itself was there, that people would start to see how that democracy works. Of course, it's kind of backfiring. We're also finding out that Israel is probably one of the most socialist places on Earth. Some of the things that we've heard coming out of there, especially from David. So, where David is at tonight? I haven't seen him. But at any rate, the maitre d' has left his keys hanging in the door and has totally disappeared. The waitresses are gone. And they only got half the chairs put up, so I guess that leaves it to me. You left the light shining brightly here. But, hey, folks, the chat is obviously going to be open. The bar is open for another night, for the rest of the night here. And the room, of course, will be going, so chat will be going strong. But for all of you listeners out there in Radio World, thank you for listening to the Politics Cafe at www.hernerco.com and the ASI Radio Network. Folks, I probably will not be here next week. The show will be hosted by my buddy Rizzo. We've been making last-minute plans and preparations for the wedding. It's going to be nuts. I'm giving away my oldest daughter. This is a new moment in my life, and my wife is driving me crazy with the preparations. I'm going to tell you right now, we're just going out of our minds here. So I think Mr. Rizzo will be here next week, and folks, wish me well, and I will see you the week after the wedding there, and we'll be back, and we'll talk about everything. I'll be seeing some of you guys during the week in the room here. You know, in the mornings I still have a little bit of peace. You know, I'm managing to get up at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning ahead of everyone else, so I can get an hour or two in on the internet. Yeah, a haircut. Deb, I don't have any hair. It's been pulled out. All right, good night, folks. Good night from the Politics Cafe, www.hernco.com and the ASI Radio Network. See you later, folks.